What is consciousness? Where does it come from? How is self-awareness different from the soul? What makes a person a person? Does our understanding of human consciousness force us to question ideas like evolution or even the existence of God? We're going to be talking about all of that and more on today's episode of Theology on Air. Well, welcome back to Theology on Air. I am Sarah Stone. I'm the Outreach Director for Young Adults at NBPC. I'm joined almost as usual by my co-producer here, Evan McClanahan, pastor, senior pastor at First Lutheran in Midtown, Houston. And we're joined today by a very special guest, Josh Rasmussen, who is a professor of philosophy at Azusa Pacific University. He specializes in analytic metaphysics. Woo, I'm already confused. And he's the author of 5 books, including his most recent, How Reason Can Lead to God. And we're going to be picking his brain today about personhood and the mind and consciousness and all that crazy abstract stuff. But before we get into that, let me just say a couple things. Theology on Tap is online now, so you can check out our website, I don't know why I say that. Nobody puts that in anymore. HoustonTOT.com.
You didn't include HTTPS.
/// Yeah, okay. HoustonTOT.com. Check that out. And if you're listening to us on the podcast, rate us and review us, but only if it's a good review, because
we don't want the bad ones.
No, we don't. We don't want haters. Okay. So Theology on Tap, as many of you know, is this idea where a bunch of young adults in Houston get together for craft beer and talk about interesting things. And then here on the podcast, we get to dig in even further. So I think that's all of our preliminary stuff. Josh, why don't you start us off by just telling us a little bit about you, like your own story, your story of faith, and then maybe how you became interested in such big, like kind of esoteric ideas.
Yeah, thank you. Well, it's great to be with you.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I have lots of stories. There's not just this one defining story, but I was thinking that I am me, a person, but what makes me unique, right? I don't know. I'm married to Rachel Rasmussen, who happens to be the most beautiful woman on the earth, objectively. So I guess that makes me unique in that respect. I'm passionate about understanding the foundations. And I think that for me, I just discovered that there was this thing called philosophy sometime in college. I was just discovering books and websites. The internet came out early in my college days, and I discovered there was this thing called philosophy, and I realized this is something that I've always been interested in. I've always wanted to know. One of my earliest memories was trying to figure out how far the numbers go and the nature of infinity. Like I remember asking my dad, I was like, "Dad, is God infinite?" And my dad said, "Yes." And I said, is there a highest number? He said, "No, they're infinite." So they're both infinite. I said, "Well, Dad, does that mean the numbers are as big as God?"
Oh.
And he said, I still remember this. My dad said, "No, that God is bigger. He's bigger than the numbers." And that was confusing to me because it seemed like, well, if they're both infinite, they're the same size. So I was kind of, I remember in second grade wondering how I knew that my classmates were real.
Hmm.
And not just imaginary images.
You were in second grade and you were doing like the Cartesian demon kind of thing.
It's not like I was worried about it. Okay.
Well,
let me make sure that's clear. I wasn't worried about it, but I was wondering about it. I was like wondering, how do I know? So I didn't know there was this thing.
When you look back in your yearbook, are there like people missing? Like,
oh my gosh.
You know, maybe you imagined them or something.
Yeah, that's the Mandela effect or something.
Okay. So they were real. They really were real, just to be clear.
Probably, yeah.
Okay, all right.
Probably.
Go ahead. Yeah, I'm sorry.
I can't be certain, you know, but probably. So that's a little bit about me. What sort of got me into maybe the story that got me kind of more into professional philosophy is just discovering that there is this thing called professional philosophy. And I, late high school, my worldview sort of fell apart. Mm. Through conversation with others and reflection. And I realized I couldn't just inherit the worldview of my parents or my community, because I realized there were other parents in other communities that had a different worldview. And it seemed sort of arrogant to think that, oh, my parents, they got it right and other parents didn't.
Yeah.
So I sort of had to start over and kind of think about, okay, what's really true? And there was really no looking back after that.
Interesting. So it's just as of late that you've been fascinated by philosophy for a long time, but just lately you've been you're working on a new book, I guess, about consciousness and the mind, personhood.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
So, well, my publisher asked me if I, the publisher of How Reason Can Lead to God asked me if I was interested in doing another book. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's too early to talk about this. I haven't gotten this approved yet. So,
You heard it here first on Theology on Air. Exclusive.
Need that breaking news, like, right. Sound effect.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things that I think about is the foundations. And so far my published work has been on the foundations of existence, mm-hmm. but I'm inclined to think that persons are also foundational to existence as well. And in fact, some of my arguments in How Reason Can Lead to God are about the fundamental personality of reality. And so personhood features prominently in reality. Persons are primary, I would argue. And I've just been thinking a lot more about what that means. And so when the publisher asked me, I said, oh, well, yes, I would love to work with you on this project on persons. So that's okay. Where I've been focusing my attention now. Yeah.
So let's like define some terms and then we'll just jump right into all the juicy stuff. Consciousness, that word, what does it mean? I asked somebody at dinner last night what they thought it meant. This person's not a Christian. And he said, well, I think it's just self-awareness. But certainly it can't just be self-awareness, right? Like, how are you defining that word?
I think self-awareness is part of consciousness. Mm-hmm. Consciousness is one of those things that I think you know by encountering it. So it's hard to define it. It might be one of those sort of basic notions. You could think of it as whatever is experienced. So if I experience thought, that would be part of consciousness. If I experience a feeling or an intention, so philosophers of mind who are interested in consciousness will think about intentions, feelings, emotions, thoughts, all those things would be elements of consciousness insofar as it's experienced. Now, if it's not experienced, you might say it's unconscious. It's not part mm-hmm. of consciousness.
I already have so many questions. I'm like, what about dreams? What about hallucinations?
That's part of it too.
We'll get to that later. Yeah. So how then does consciousness, so it sounds like consciousness is something that everybody could be on board with, that it happens, that it occurs.
No, not everybody. No. Okay. Well, there's a saying among the philosophers, for every proposition P that some philosopher believes, there's another philosopher who's skeptical of P.
Okay.
For every proposition, right? So, I mean, you know, call us philosophers. Consciousness is a strange thing. I mean, it's familiar, so we might think it's not significant, but it's so significant. It's metaphysical ramifications. It's ramifications for what this world is so significant that some philosophers think that actually our world couldn't include consciousness. There are arguments for what's called eliminativism.
Okay.
So what you do is you eliminate consciousness. You treat beings as entirely analyzable, ultimately in terms of non-conscious material states. This is sometimes called eliminativist materialism.
Okay, but it sounds, the way that you defined consciousness as sort of being everything that you experience,
yeah.
thoughts, smells, what you see, everything you take in. And I can't understand how somebody would not think that's real, because that's not even a religious thing at that point, right? We haven't even brought God into it.
Oh yeah, this has nothing to do with religion. I mean, it's interesting that the philosophers who aren't religious at all are painting the pathway towards some very, very interesting conclusions just through thinking about consciousness and how there could be consciousness. I mean, there's even, we'll get into the sort of hard problem of how there could be consciousness in principle. If ultimate reality is fundamentally material, how can there be this sort of conscious experience? And I have to tell you, I mean, I met a philosopher who's a logic professor, and he said he was skeptical of his existence. And I asked him, I have a lot of respect for this position. I mean, there is a literature on eliminativist materialism. You know, it's a sophisticated viewpoint. I have a lot of respect for the arguments for this. But I was kind of probing him, you know, well, I asked him, well, don't you just sort of sense yourself through introspection? Mm-hmm. Can't you sort of see, you know, by this sort of inner light that you are there? And he said, well, yeah, he does have the intuition, but he doesn't think that the intuition is necessarily reliable.
Okay.
And neuroscience shows us that intuitions can mislead us. So we think that there's like a self, but there really isn't. It's sort of an illusion. And I think his basic argument or his problem was that he didn't see how you could have fundamentally particles that give rise to this fundamentally different kind of thing, these first person selves.
Mm-hmm.
And so he didn't think that that was how that could be possible. But he does think that reality is fundamentally particles, and so therefore there are no first person selves. Now, I don't want to read too much into his thought, but I will say that, I mean, this is a kind of argument that you could use for eliminativism.
That's interesting. Well, put that on the shelf for a minute. Yeah. Let's do this. So if consciousness is the way that you defined it, how does that differ from and how is it connected to the idea of a soul, the way that Christians think of a soul?
So the term soul is loaded. I don't like to use the term because people just mean different things by it.
Yeah.
There's just a question. I mean, some people, what they mean by it is some sort of immaterial ghostly thing. But then what do you mean by that? What do you mean by material? Mm-hmm. I sort of like to think of sort of, if I'm going to define the term soul, as a substance that bears conscious capacity, where the conscious capacity is what it seems like from the first person perspective. For example, if I'm having an experience of tasting strawberry shortcake, that taste, that experience is what it seems like fundamentally from the first person perspective. It's not the same thing as a pattern of particles that might be causally correlated with that experience in your brain. So in fact, let me just not use the term soul. So I would just say that there's something, whatever it is, that has consciousness. And then if that consciousness is not reducible to material states, and we can talk about reduction, then that something is what you might call fundamentally non-material or soulish. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's actually really helpful to me because you're right. People mean different things by the soul, but there is this kind of distinction between, I guess, tell me if I'm using these terms correctly, but kind of an ontological naturalism and something that transcends or goes beyond the natural. And if it goes beyond the natural, regardless of what you call it, then you have to ask some bigger questions, right?
Yeah.
To get to things like, is there a God? And is evolution the cause of these things or something else? And anyway, okay.
Yeah, well, again, it depends on what you mean by natural.
Okay.
So most philosophers are not eliminativists. They don't eliminate consciousness. They think that there is consciousness. But many philosophers are also naturalists. So they would say consciousness is natural. Now, among the naturalists, there's a distinction between those who reduce consciousness to the material and those who think consciousness is fundamentally what it seems to be from the first person perspective, non-reducible to the material.
How are you a naturalist, but it's not reducible to the material?
So there's a kind of non-reductive physicalism. And this is under the broad umbrella of naturalism. Again, it comes down to how you define the term. So the term natural is one of those loaded terms. I would almost rather not use it. Or if I'm going to use it, I'm in this Facebook group called Naturalism. And what I've discovered from that Facebook group is that a core part of Christian theology is actually consistent with a core view of naturalism according to how naturalists define it. So what I've discovered is there's a lot of talking past each other.
And, sounds like politics.
There's actually like a lot of overlap that people don't see because of these terms.
Instead of a Facebook group called Naturalism, you need like four Facebook groups with subsets of different kinds of naturalism so that you can actually talk to.
Oh my gosh.
Reductive naturalism, non-reductive naturalism. That's right.
So I'm thinking about, let's say I'm doing outreach to college student and I'm not a philosopher and maybe they're in like one philosophy class or something and they don't believe in God and, you know, something like that. What I'm thinking about is how these ideas eventually filter down to an average person, of which I am one. Okay. And so like college students might believe in, you know, like, oh, we're just like animals, you know, we're just material thing. They might even say the word naturalism or something, but they don't know how to define that. I guess I want to know before we go further, like, why is this important? What are the ideas around consciousness that are dangerous from a Christian point of view? Because I mean, that's where I would come from. Mm-hmm. And how do they filter down? In what way would they filter down? What would that sound like if an average person got a hold of, say, Daniel Dennett's ideas? Because he's someone who rejects consciousness, right? Like, he's the only guy I know that, you know, one of the big names or whatever that
he rejects qualia.
Oh, okay.
Which is a certain aspect.
Yeah, I was about to say that.
Exactly. And I've heard that word. Eric Hernandez used that word a lot. But anyway, what are the ways in which misunderstanding this idea kind of gets dangerous to an average person? And then how would we, as someone who wants to defend the existence of God or defend personhood, as we'll get into, How would we respond to that?
First, I just want to say, I think philosophy takes courage, and it takes courage to face the danger. So it is dangerous to be a philosopher. It's a danger. It's dangerous to go out into the wilderness of the unexplored and the uncharted. And I actually think, I mean, this might not be what you're expecting me to say. I think there's something good about facing dangerous ideas, toying with them, and not necessarily building a fence that protects us from them. At the same time, I hear what you're asking. I mean, you're asking, like, what's really at stake here? You know,
yeah.
What's at stake when we're thinking about consciousness? How do your worldviews divide over this?
Right.
And I think that fundamentally, what consciousness points to when you're thinking about your mind and your thoughts, is it points to a reality that transcends what is explainable wholly in terms of shapes, patterns of shapes, particles in motion. It points to something transcendent. I mean, even if you're talking about truth, you know, if an atheist says, I want to get to the truth about this. Well, what is this thing, truth? Is it a rock? Is it a set of particles? Can you destroy the truth of mathematics, for example? What is the nature of truth? And I would say, well, truth is actually something that's featured in thoughts, which is featured in minds. And so it's already, the concept of truth itself is already, it's like a window through which you can see that there's more to the world than just shapes and patterns of shapes and matter.
So what do you say to somebody who would say that, whether you're calling it consciousness or soul or even mind, that it's just an emergent property of, you know, evolution has taken us to the point where the mind is so advanced and so wonderful that has produced this thing that we call consciousness or we call the soul?
Yeah, it might be emergent, but how does it emerge? Why does it emerge? In fact, I was actually just asking my class, this was their homework for the weekend, was what is it about consciousness emerging from non-consciousness that may be different from wetness emerging from non-wetness? That's like my homework question for the weekend for them. But I actually think
Tell us the correct answer, and then we will bribe your students with this podcast. Yeah. No, I'm kidding.
Well, I don't know if there's really a correct answer. I mean, it's a thinking question that kind of opens up your thoughts about this. I mean, so when I think about it, and I'm still thinking about that. I mean, this already takes me to the edge of my own thinking. This is an open question for me, how all these things work. But when I think about what wetness is fundamentally, it seems like wetness is already something that's experienced in consciousness. It's like wetness already presupposes an element of consciousness. And I'm still wondering how there could be any kind of experiencer in the first place. It's not that I think that fundamental reality is wet. Okay, it's not that.
Right.
But my thought is that is if fundamental reality has some sort of conscious producing powers, then that could allow reality to unfold to produce beings like us. If reality doesn't have consciousness producing powers, then I don't see how there could be beings like us. So the whole question is, how can reality have consciousness producing powers? How is emergence even possible? How can people be produced in the first place? I sometimes like to distinguish between a prediction problem and a construction problem. So the prediction problem is it's the problem of figuring out a worldview that would successfully predict consciousness. Right. So if you have a foundational mind, it seems to me that that would provide predictive resources to make the emergence of consciousness not so improbable. So that's the kind of prediction. If instead you just have fundamental matter, you just have, let's say, particles, right? That doesn't seem to predict consciousness. I mean, even if you get evolution, because people say, well, eventually over time, you're going to evolution, that will lead to greater complexity through natural selection. But you could imagine an evolution of consciousless, mindless machines, right? You don't have a prediction of consciousness just from materialism without building in auxiliary hypotheses that make the proposal more complex. The construction problem is an additional problem of how is it possible, even in principle, to construct consciousness out of non-consciousness? An example of this would be like, let's say that you wanted to build a sad snowman, okay? You don't want the snowman to just look sad. You know, you make an upside down, you know, make it a frowny face and maybe put some tears down its eyes or whatever. You could take some kids over and say, is that snowman feeling sad? Is it really sad? And kids would know, it's not. It's not, but why not? How do you know that it's not actually feeling sad by making it look or function as if it feels sad.
Hmm.
And I think there's a construction problem at work here. I think there's a kind of intuition that functioning as if you look sad is not sufficient for sadness. Function is not enough. It's not enough to look sad. You have to actually be sad. And the being of sad is something else.
Yeah.
Yeah. Does that make sense?
I like the illustration. I'm also wondering, you have children, right?
I do. 4 children.
Oh, nice. I'm 1 of 4. it just made
so
me think.
So am I, by the way. I'm 1 of 4 as well.
It made me
think. So is my wife. But anyway.
What would it be like to be your child? Because I'm just imagining like normal households having normal conversations. And you're like, guys, what do you think of this sad snowman? No, that's not correct. You see, you have a construction problem. Anyway, let's take this back to a level that even people that maybe don't understand all of what we're talking about right now are interested in, which is, I told you that we had Eric Hernandez on recently talking about the soul. And he actually said that he thinks that animals have souls. I don't know if I agree or not, but when we talk about consciousness, do you think, I mean, as the way that you first described it, experiential, self-awareness, the sort of being the natural or the maybe not natural isn't the right word, but do you think that animals experience that? And if so, certainly not all animals, right? I mean, obviously an elephant knows more than a roach, but we know more than an elephant.
Yeah. So there are differences, right? We have a cat. His name is Hoodie. Kids love him. I don't mind having him around, but he acts like he has emotions. Now, like I said, acting like you have emotions is not sufficient for having emotions, but it can give you evidence that the thing has emotion. It's not metaphysically or ontologically sufficient to make emotion, but it can be a clue that the thing has emotion. So I do think that our cat is capable of experience. Now, does that mean that it has a soul? Well, again, it depends on what you mean by soul.
Yeah.
If what you mean is a bearer or a substance or a something, let's say, that's capable of experience, then it would at least have a soul in that sense. When I first started taking courses in the philosophy of mind, J.P. Moreland, he was the first one to introduce me to the idea that animals have souls, but he said they have souls, but they may not have permanent souls. So there's that distinction.
Hmm. Well, it seems like even if an animal, like a dog comes up to you when you're sad and kind of puts his head on your knee and you think, oh, but there's a conditioned response there, right? Like that there's something conditional that's happening there, whether or not he's thinking to himself, this poor fellow is sad. But
and if I make him happy, he'll give me a treat.
That's right. But, yeah. But if humans, I feel like are the only ones, at least as far as I know of, I haven't been talking to a lot of like dolphins lately, but that are actually sitting here having conversations about the soul. It's sort of this like meta conversation. We are wondering if we have consciousness. I don't know. Again, we don't speak the same language, but I just don't see animals doing that. So it seems like there's something special.
There's something
unique.
Yeah, I was going to say, you want to know that we're special, that there's something.
Yes,
that we
tell
have,
me I'm special, Josh.
You know, but maybe the animals could be special too. You know, we don't have to be exclusively special. But yeah, no, I'm right with you. That's a nice distinction there. About our ability to reflect on our consciousness. It seems like we have a capacity to think about our thinking.
Yeah.
This is where we get language. We can write down our thoughts precisely because we can think about our thoughts. And it's unclear that non-human animals are capable of that. You know, maybe after more evolution, they could get there or something. That's how we got there.
Some people think that, yeah.
Right. Yeah, I'm just kind of playing with you here, but depends on how we define our terms.
Yeah.
And I think that's really what's at stake here. And so I would argue that, yeah, we do have these capacities like for language and for reflection on our reflection, feeling, we can have thoughts about our feelings. And this does seem to be pretty significant, makes us special. I think you're already special if you can have consciousness. Like having consciousness is already a category that sets you apart from rocks and leaves blowing in the wind. And I don't know. I mean, I don't have this all figured out, but like, I'm not sure if the jump from being able to think about your thoughts or the thought from the jump from not being able to think about your thoughts, but having thoughts to being able to think about your thoughts, if that jump is more significant than the jump from being a pile of leaves to having conscious capacity.
Yeah.
I wonder if that first jump is really like the most significant jump.
Yeah, I wanted you to tell me I was special, but then you were like, you're essentially more special than a pile of leaves or a rock. So we took a step backwards there. Anyway.
All animals are special, but some animals are more special than others or something like
so
that.
I'm just an
I
animal.
Orwell said that.
Yeah. You're way more special than a pile of leaves. That's what I'm trying to say.
I really appreciate you coming on. Yes. Okay. That's going to increase the pay.
I was thinking, you mentioned language. I was thinking of the way the animals do communicate. Like, a honeybee can like tell other bees through like weird dancing, like mm-hmm. 5 miles away, there's like, take a left and there's some flowers and then you get some great nectar. It's really bizarre. So it's an amazing bees creation. Are. You know, we don't have to have all the answers, I guess, to
that's
that.
Good point.
But, yeah.
So in preparation for this, I listened to a few YouTube recordings about consciousness and the soul and personhood. And one thing that came up in every single one of them was this thing that philosophers call the hard problem of consciousness. Tell us a little bit about that. I mean, we've already kind of been talking about it, I think, if I understand correctly.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you can sort of think of it as the problem of like, you know, why is it that a rock isn't conscious, but then if you organize matter in a different way, it is conscious? Like how can just mere changes in organization of matter result in this sort of deep difference between having a first person sense of being, hi, I'm real,
yeah,
and not having that, right? And it's a deep problem. It's a hard problem because it's hard to see in principle how to solve it. Chalmers, a philosopher who coined this term, hard problem, not a theist philosopher, he would be a naturalist. And he describes this problem as something that can't be solved in principle by empirical science. It's not mm-hmm. just a matter of figuring out which physical things are connected with which conscious states. It's the deeper problem of understanding how there can be a connection in the first place. How is it that an axon firing can be correlated with the feeling of happiness?
Yeah.
That's the deeper problem.
So to answer the hard problem, unless you're going to give the typical Sunday school answer, which I'm happy to do, which is to say God did it, right? If you're not going to do that, you mentioned in some of our emails, there are several kind of common responses to this. Yeah. And we've already talked about this eliminativism.
That's right.
Mercy, yeah. That's a hard word to say.
Mm-hmm. Eliminate the problem. Yeah.
We talked a little bit about emergence or emergent properties, but there are a couple others. Do you have one on, I'm going to try to say this one too. Protopanpsychism. What is that?
Okay. So this is under the broad umbrella of some consciousness or something like consciousness is foundational to reality, sort of built into the foundational fabric of reality. And so some philosophers Chalmers himself has developed this sort of proto-panpsychist view to account for how there could be consciousness like us, that the consciousness we have. To start with the kind of proto or conscious-like properties, maybe sort of a proto-sense of feeling happy, a proto-sense of feeling curious. These are embedded into the sort of smallest things. And then through time and chance, those things come together and form complex organisms that have these experiences.
Not to give the four-year-old answer here, but, or question, you say built into or put in place, but like by who?
Well, okay. Or I what? Mean, right. So I'm using anthropomorphic language, right? But it's by accident would be one idea. On purpose would be another. So actually, this kind of proto-panpsychism, I think, kind of opens up the door to what explains even the proto-conscious states. So that's the right question, I think, to ask. It's like, where do those proto-conscious states come from originally? What sort of explains them?
Seems like my Sunday school answer is going strong here.
Well, so I mean, at some level, I mean, so here's a objection to the Sunday school answer, right? So if I were in your Sunday school class, I would be
let's hope that never happens.
the pesky student asking questions, like I did when I was in Sunday school. Not that I'm not in Sunday school now, but they don't really have it at my church. So anyway,
he's in California.
If they did, I would keep bugging them with questions. But so let's say that God is sort of the locus of consciousness, right? But we can still ask, well, where did God get his consciousness from? What, we're relocating the hard problem to God's consciousness. Like, what kicks off God's consciousness? And if you say nothing, God just automatically conscious without any cause, then the naturalist could just say the same thing about nature. Nature just has basic consciousness without any.
But don't we already do that when we're not talking about consciousness? We do that when we're talking about like cosmological argument or something else, like the existence of God. We don't say, well, then who caused God to exist? That's the whole point, is that he's the uncaused cause. Can we not say that about consciousness? Is that like breaking some philosophical rule to say?
Well, I mean, this is the response to the cosmological argument, which is that, look, you religious person who wants to believe in God, posit your uncaused thing. You have no problem with that. So I'm going to posit my uncaused thing.
Okay.
So we've got symmetry.
Gotcha.
Now, I think that you're pointing us in the right direction, which is there a way to break that symmetry? Is there something about God that would explain why God could be uncaused that the material world wouldn't have? And similarly, is there something about God that would explain how God could be conscious and uncaused in God's consciousness that material things would lack?
Give us the answer then. What is it?
Okay, so the answer, I mean, I like to give questions for people to think about, right? Because that's what leads to insight. But so in my book, How Reason Can Lead to God, I use this question actually as a device to lead us to what I think is a relevant difference between the caused and the uncaused. And the most fundamental relevant difference that I argue for is perfection. Mm-hmm. So I think anything less than perfect would have some kind of fundamental limit that calls for further explanation. Whereas a fundamentally perfect thing wouldn't have that. And then from perfection, I think we can get the predictions. We can get perfect knowledge, perfect power, perfect goodness. And perfect knowledge then would imply, I think, at least the conscious capacities.
I almost said that earlier because I heard you say it in a YouTube video earlier, but I didn't want to like be that student that's like, oh, I cheated and I know the answer. So, okay. Well, you mentioned something just then that brings me to another question. You said something about perfect goodness.
Yeah.
So I think sometimes when people talk about consciousness, there's a pretty close relationship between consciousness and morality, right? Consciousness and conscience. And the guy that I was talking to last night even said something about a sense of right and wrong, maybe is another thing that sort of distinguishes us from I don't know, roaches. I keep going back to roaches because they're just so terrible.
They don't have any sense of right or wrong. They just do wrong things all the time.
Or they have a sense of it and they enjoy doing wrong. Yeah, so it makes them like demons
they're
or something.
Wicked. Yeah, they're wicked. Yeah. They're evil.
But maybe talk a little bit about that, like your thoughts on the connection between exploring consciousness and morality. Is that too broad a question?
No, I get the question. It's a good one because it's about the different kinds of consciousness. It's not just that we have consciousness in general. Mm-hmm. It's that we have very specific types of consciousness that those types also call for explanation. Like we have this capacity to sense that something's going wrong.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. That's really, I mean, just like ponder that. Like you can imagine an evolution that leads to conscious beings that feel cold and hot, but never have a sense about purpose or a path of righteousness or something. There's no sense like that. Why is there a sense that's so specifically about good and bad? That's a kind of striking feature of consciousness.
We have somebody on Facebook that said a dog knows when they do something wrong sometimes. And I was getting ready to comment back. Do they, or is that a conditioned response? Like a dog.
It really sounds like you have this belief, this limit. I want to say a limit. I'm just playing with you here. You've got a limiting belief that in order for you to be special, you have to be distinguished from the non-human animals.
I already know I am distinguished from a non-human animal. That's the Bible tells me so, Josh, good grief. I can't write back to these people in real time.
I'm reminded of a story though about a guy who tried to potty train his dog. And so every time his dog would go in the house, he would go take his dog and stick his nose in it. Mm-hmm. You know, like, you bad dog, look what you did. And so the next time the dog did that in the house, the dog ran over to it and stuck his nose in it. You know, like, this is no punishment to me, you know? So he didn't mind the smell of his own poop. So all he was teaching him to do was to go smell his own stuff. So I'm sure there's a sermon illustration.
That's a wonderful story. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, the point is like the dog knew that it had done something wrong to some degree because it responded to its training, but did it actually like feel a certain way? Did it actually know the difference between right and wrong?
Or have regret or guilt or
It seems different. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, within the moral landscape, there are these distinctions, even if it could have some sense of positive versus negative. That's different from these sort of higher ordered moral concepts that we have.
I want to take us a little bit of a different direction. I'm trying to squeeze in a lot of stuff that people have asked me to ask you. But this one, several of my friends and family have suggested that I take shrooms, partly because they think it'd be very funny because I've never taken any drugs. Like I'm one of those goody goodies that like I never even smoked a cigarette. So I think they just think they'd be hilarious to watch me on something. But apparently shrooms are supposed to sort of access the part of the brain that's like the faith part of the brain. I'm putting that in quotes for those listening on the podcast, the quote faith part of the brain. So I'm curious about your thoughts about psychedelics and maybe even like microdosing. That's kind of a new and big thing and how that might help us understand our personhood. Is that something you've thought about?
I think the safest answer would be to say I really just don't know. I haven't had those experiences, so I can't speak to them. I do think that it's sort of interesting. There's this whole sort of research into out-of-body experiences and near-death mm-hmm. experiences where there's this sort of question about whether you can even sort of study this scientifically and mechanically. Like there are mm-hmm. things that you do to the brain and then you pop out of the body and then you could maybe like test what's going on there. But yeah, these are definitely at the edges of my own thinking, and I don't have that experience, so I can't really
yeah.
speak from experience.
It's funny you mentioned that because somebody else asked something like there are cases where people are essentially dead and then they sort of come back and they can tell you things that happened like in the room when their yeah. brain was sort
or of in other rooms or in other places in the city. I've oh, read of these geez. As well.
That's not creepy at all.
Yeah, no, Gary Habermas uses a lot of those stories to kind of take one step towards mm-hmm. the possibility of resurrection. I don't know that I like that argument per se, but it he does pull up a lot of
In the philosophy of mind, you don't even need to think that those are veridical. As long as those are even possible, you can then build an argument for the distinction between you and your body. The reason for that is because it's not possible for a body B to not be that same body B. But so if it's possible for me to be distinct from my body, that's enough for me there to be something true of me that's not true of my body, namely possible distinction from.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
If that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So if I were to take psychedelic drugs and have an experience, would it be a real experience, right? So mm-hmm. like if I hallucinate, if I see roaches crawling on my arm,
oh, gosh. You know,
because I took too much methamphetamine for too long, is that real?
Do you mean by real?
Okay. Yes.
We have to get better questions for when we have philosophers yeah. on.
Well, I mean, I guess I always think about talking to someone where this is going to filter down in a very basic yeah, way or something.
That's good.
You know,
it's important.
And so, I guess for me, if I'm defending Christianity, I'm defending true historical events that can be, mm-hmm. In some way, defended, verified, that sort of thing. But if they came back and were to say, well, people hallucinate all the time, and maybe they hallucinated Jesus' resurrection appearances or something like that. So I'm just trying to figure out, I guess, I mean, can we operate with different definitions of reality or?
Hmm.
I think I see where you're going here. So when we're talking about near-death experiences, there's a question about whether the experience actually matches something outside of them or whether it's sort of generated just from within them. And if it's generated from within them, it might be kind of like a hallucination. And so that's kind of maybe an open question for you in terms of how much evidence those experiences would have. But I would like to point to something that's even more basic and more clear, which is that even if the hallucination doesn't match an external reality, it's still true that you're having an experience. Mm-hmm. Okay. And this is one of those things, I just need to emphasize this because sometimes we mistake the familiar for the insignificant. We experience something, it's so familiar, like the existence of other people or just love or our own thoughts. And so we don't realize just how profoundly significant it is that these elements are part of reality at all. I mean, if you just go back, you just think, how can there be a reality with something in it? That's already a bizarre question. But then if it's going to be filled with something, how would it be filled and why would it be filled specifically with people who can have experiences? And let me just tag one more thing to this, because I think you can demonstrate that you are more than just matter just by being aware of your own experiences, whether it's a hallucination or not. And the argument for this would be that there's something true of your experience that's not true of material states in your brain. Namely, you have direct access to it. You have direct access to what you're thinking and what you're feeling. You don't have direct access to what your brain is doing. So mm-hmm. even while there's a correlation between material states and feeling states, just like there's a correlation between piano keys playing and music coming from the piano keys, there's not a reduction there. Mm-hmm. An example I like to give is a coin with a head side and a tail side. You spin the tail side and the head side spins with it. But that doesn't mean the tail side is the head side. Mm. In fact, you can show that they're different in the same way that I just argued that your mind is not material. You are aware of the heads without being aware of the tails. That's possible. So there's something true of the heads. It's not true of the tails. Namely, it can be an object of your awareness while you're not aware of the other. Hmm. And in the same way, I would say with consciousness, even more severe, because you can't even be directly aware of your brain. You can be aware of the mm-hmm. heads or the tails, at least indirectly, but you can't be directly aware of your brain. You're only aware of your brain through your experience. Mm-hmm. Only your experience is an object of direct awareness.
Yeah. And you're not like, oh, that was my 400th dendrite that just fired.
That's it. Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly it. Yeah. And
I think the answer here is that Evan and I need to take shrooms and record a podcast, maybe right after the election. That'd be a doozy.
Or peyote. Would that work? Isn't that what it's called?
Peyote? That's like old school peyote. Oh, okay. Now it's like ayahuasca or something.
I know we're getting towards the end, and it's okay. I hope if we go a little past, because I'm just itching to add one more thing here.
I'm itching to add like three more things. What were you going to say?
Yeah. So when we're talking about hallucinations, sometimes people say, well, that's not real. Okay. Well, it's not real in the sense that it corresponds, let's say, with an outer reality. Mm-hmm. But here's evidence that there is a reality that you're aware of, even when you're having a hallucination or when you're having a dream. Okay. Is that you can actually focus on different parts of your experience and distinguish them from mm-hmm. one another. Like I could have a dream of a red wall next to a blue wall, and I can distinguish the red side from the blue side within my own experience. Now, it's not that there's really a red wall or a blue wall, mm-hmm. but there's an experience of red, an experience of blue. And if those were nothing, then you couldn't distinguish them. Hmm. You can distinguish them. So they're not nothing. There's something there that you are aware of.
Hmm. Yeah. I have been trying lucid dreaming lately. That's been fun. Hmm. Another conversation for another day. While we're talking about kind of alternative consciousness, whether it's because of drugs or because you're dreaming, I'm curious about this. We've been having a few conversations here and there about like Christian mysticism, some of Richard Rohr's teachings. Some of us like him, some of us do not like him. But there's kind
I like
of this,
him.
You do.
Does that mean boy. I just alienated myself?
Well, remember I told you, you're never going to offend everybody on our leadership.
Did I offend you?
No, go ahead.
So this idea of contemplative prayer, I've heard some people say, or at least some Christian mystics, I guess, mm-hmm. that it allows kind of an alternate state of consciousness, which seems a little bit strange to me. I mean, I don't know how much you know about the idea of contemplative prayer. I don't mean contemplative prayer just like, I'm contemplating something. That's mm-hmm. nice. But that there's kind of this goal of achieving a different state of consciousness. Is that something you think can happen through prayer?
This is not something I've really looked into. So, I mean, I would turn it around and ask you, what do you think?
No. Is that another limiting
principle?
Well,
it's a good thing I didn't say yes on that question.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. And I don't even know how I would define an alternate state of consciousness, because everything we've talked about mm-hmm. has just been about like sort of it's real because it's your experience of it. So what There's would be an alternate states. Of that? It's still going to be me experiencing it. So
yeah, good point. Yeah.
I would just say it's unnecessary.
Yeah.
Because God has sufficiently revealed himself in the word. And so I'm a Lutheran. So we have a strong, as do Presbyterians, of course, you know, strong love for the word and God's revolution. And I think that when people start seeking external or alternative revelation from God, they can open doors that ought not to be opened. Uh-huh. And how would you distinguish if it's really from God anyway? What would your standard be? You're back to scripture. So why do it anyway? So, yeah.
Yeah, I got you. That makes sense.
But I know that there have been mystics through the ages that we, you know, read and appreciate. And Can I go back and ask a question? Mm-hmm. Okay. I don't know how exactly related this is to consciousness, but we kind of flirted with this a few minutes ago. And I'm going to try to do my very best to answer this directly. We were talking about like how, like in the cosmological argument, we talked about God, right? And we kind of say, well, God never began to exist. He just exists mm-hmm. by definition. And then an unbeliever can say, well, nature just exists. So you have the competing claims. And in essence, each side could claim that the other is being circular in their reasoning, you know?
Yeah.
But aren't there differences in those two circles? In other words, can't nature really not account for itself, but God really can, right? So in essence, isn't... when we're talking about the very edges of, you know, of life itself, of existence itself, mm-hmm. you're going to have a circular reasoning. It's inescapable. Now, within, mm-hmm. you know, small arguments, circular reasoning is bad. But when you're talking about the very, very fundamentals of existence, you can't avoid circular reasoning. Like, you have to get to a point where you just say, well, it just is. And either God just is or nature just is. Mm-hmm. But isn't the problem with saying nature just is? I'm leading the witness. Tell me where I'm wrong. But I mean, this would be my argument for the existence of God. It's like, you can't argue that nature must exist, but God, you can say that God must exist. And maybe that ties in with consciousness in the sense that to know that you exist or to experience mm-hmm. consciousness as a kind of brute fact or a strong intuition or something to that effect, mm-hmm. You can't really explain it at the end of the day, but you know it so strongly that you can mm-hmm. defend it on those grounds. I don't know.
Yeah, there's a lot there, because I want to distinguish between the sort of foundations of knowledge. You talked about circular reasoning. That makes me think of knowledge versus foundations of existence. Mm-hmm. And so I think what you're saying applies to both. My own view is that the foundation of existence is not circular. It's just foundational.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But I think that God provides a better foundation than matter. I think matter has arbitrary complexities and limitations that call for further explanation, whereas God doesn't have those. He's just perfect. So I think there's a relevant difference there. Mm. With respect to knowledge, I was thinking back actually about if you were my kid, you know, how I would engage the kids. One of my kids, he's 11 now, he asked me a question. He said, Dad, I've been thinking of you know how you ask me questions, Dad, that I can't answer? I've been thinking of a question that you can't answer.
Oh, I love it.
And yeah, it was great. And his question was, how can there be knowledge? How can there be knowledge? And it was basically really getting to the very issue of how can knowledge get started? Does it start in a circular way?
Your 11-year-old asked you this?
Well, he asked me because he didn't know the answer, right? Like he thought maybe he would stump me on this.
Working on my parenting. That's pretty deep for an 11-year-old.
So he was trying to stump me there. And but my answer is ultimately that there is knowledge, that it's not that it's circular. It's just that it's not based on other knowledge. Okay. It's basic knowledge. And so when it comes to thinking about God, I would want to just distinguish between the sort of foundations of knowledge versus the foundations of existence. And so it's a further question whether you could know God sort of prior to knowledge of anything else. I think that mm-hmm. might depend on the person, but I do think God is foundational to existence.
And I asked one of our kind of TOT regulars, he's a mystic himself, and thinks about things pretty differently from the way I think about things, but I'm always intrigued by him. So I asked him if he had any questions for today. And one of the questions, well, we've been sort of dancing around this idea of like God's aseity, right? That he is self-existent. Mm-hmm. And so when God calls himself, I am, remember with Moses at the burning bush, this person's question is, does that mean that as we become more aware of our reality, that we find more union with God? Now, mm-hmm. he might say, and I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I think in Christian mysticism, there may even be this idea that we become more God-like. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that. He might be saying that. I don't know. But do you think that we sort of, as we become more aware of our consciousness and explore these ideas, have more closeness with God?
I think we discover our similarities.
Okay.
So it's interesting. One of my friends, I haven't looked into this, but he said that the term for being in the image of God comes mm-hmm. from the idea of being an icon of God. Mm. So it's kind of like we're representing him in sort of this deep way. So as we discover ourselves, we're actually discovering more about the nature of the creator. Now there's limits to this, because if we are created, then we're not going to discover that we're uncreated in that sense. We're limited, not perfect. But yeah, I do think that discovering more of yourself, the nature of consciousness, does reveal more of the nature of, the way I like to put it in neutral terms, the foundation of existence. You know, whether you believe in God or not, I mean, it's like your existence is a clue into the fabric of fundamental existence, because mm-hmm. fundamental existence, whatever it is, wherever you come from, has to somehow have the resources to produce people. And so when you discover the nature of people through reflection on thoughts, feelings, logic — what is logic? We just take it for granted. Logical relations, the desire for the good, all those things are produced by the fabric of the foundation. Somehow the foundation has those resources. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I do. And I think that for me, maybe as a philosopher, even brings me into kind of worship of God, because mm-hmm. I see that there's something in me. Even my access to principles of reason is an access to something that transcends me. Mm-hmm. you know, because reason doesn't, like, the principles of the laws of logic don't depend on me thinking about them. They transcend me. So it does bring me into kind of closeness to God, I think, in that way.
Yeah, that's very cool.
Maybe this is a quick question, but you started talking about people, and we've mentioned personhood, and I think that was one of the questions in there. But I'm curious, this is maybe getting into moral territory, but if you think about something like abortion, one of the arguments mm-hmm. sort of in favor of it being sort of tolerated, I guess, is that, well, you know, you're not, I mean, in fact, there are distinctions now between a human being and a person, mm-hmm. right? I mean, it used to be that, well, it's not a human being. And now it's definitely a human being. We know it's a human being, et cetera. But now people say, well, personhood doesn't begin until such and such a time. And my argument is that whatever time you pick on that time frame is always going to be arbitrary, right? And it seems like people will say even like, well, until it's, you know, sort of knows, I don't know, until it can live on its own. And I'm like,
that's ridiculous.
That's not until they're like 25, you know? So especially these days with video gaming and all that. But I don't know. I'm just curious as to like, if you thought about or answered the question of like, when a small human being is somehow, can we know if they're aware of their existence? Or if we define personhood by something like being aware of your existence, doesn't that pose a problem, you know?
So maybe define personhood.
Yes. So I tend to think that personhood is one of those basic notions. So that's sort of unhelpful. However, I do think a good criteria, perhaps a sufficient condition, would be having the capacity for awareness. Maybe we could add self-awareness, but it's a capacity. And so that capacity may not be actualized until you grow in size or have certain experiences. Mm-hmm. But as long as you have that capacity, as long as you're the kind of
thing. The potential for it.
Yes, as long as you're the kind of thing that could have, as long as you have the potential for it, you're the kind of thing that has it. So the idea is like leaves don't even have the potential mm-hmm. to be aware. There's nothing you could do to leaves to make them aware. I would argue, I'm really convinced of this, that a sperm and an egg, its geometric properties, if all that a sperm and an egg are, is material things characterized by its geometric and physical properties, there's nothing you could do to a sperm and egg. You couldn't put them into each other. You could do nothing to them to make it so that they're even possibly conscious. Nothing. So it's the wrong kind of thing. But if instead what goes on is that there's something within nature, maybe sperm and egg come together, that opens up a sort of opportunity for a person to be generated. Okay. Then you have the kind of thing that is potentially aware.
That's good.
Which is why, because people will say that they'll say that a sperm is life and an egg is life, you know, and because they're trying to undercut the argument that life begins at conception. You know, they say, well, that's alive.
Yeah. Well,
the
broccoli is life. Yeah.
Well, it's like, well, yeah, the sperm is alive, but it requires the egg to create this new person that, as you would say, that's very helpful, has the capacity eventually for consciousness. And so I agree, I don't know how to put it in a fancy way, so I'm like, yeah, personhood is a brute factor. It's very basic, right?
Foundational. Likes that word.
Foundational, basic.
But
that's interesting. So that is very helpful to know, think about it in terms of capacities, because even a person could be 30 years old but maybe have a mental
Or you go into a coma, you know, are you no longer a person? Well, as long as there's the potential, and even if the potential can't be realized, given the environment or the circumstance or the damage, doesn't mean that you don't have that.
That's really good. That's a good distinction. Yeah. I like that. Okay. Since we're talking about persons, I think I would disappoint a lot of people if I didn't ask you about like robots and AI and all that kind of stuff. So we did a Theology on Tap once on transhumanism. And the lady basically said transhumanism can be thought of as super longevity, super intelligence, super happiness. The first and the third don't apply to our conversation as much, but when it comes to super intelligence, so like the singularity or AI is taking over, that kind of thing, I'm curious how some of your thoughts might inform, or some of the things that you've studied might inform your thoughts on whether that's possible. Are the AIs going to take over, Josh, is what I'm asking.
Are you worried about that?
I'm actually not worried about that because
even if it happens, you're still special. I just want to make sure you know
get me. But then my desire to be special is a limiting basic principle.
It's anyway. A limiting belief. No, just teasing. So, okay. So first thing I would say, I don't think you can build conscious beings from unconscious machine parts. I don't think that's possible. But
what kind of gets at what you were just talking about with potential.
That's continue, right.
Sorry.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So, I don't think silicon even has the potential to be to be conscious in and of itself. But I do think that once you have conscious beings, then material stuff can provide gateways or windows or whatever metaphor you want for consciousness to operate through or to flow through or to see through. And so I think that there are ways of altering our consciousness. I mean, look, if I wave my hand, I'm altering your visual field right now, your conscious visual field. Okay, I'm changing something physical, my hand, the geometry of my hand, it's affecting your consciousness. So we already know that's possible. And I don't know that there's really, that anybody knows the limits to that. You know, maybe we could build machines that enhance our conscious experience. I mean, we already have machines that allow us to be better at chess working with those machines, right? And so, I mean, those are all products of mind, of course. You know, it's not like we have machine learning that is able to get going without a mind setting up the parameters for the machine learning.
Right.
Itself.
Talk about emergent property. I mean, it's like emergent from us.
That's it. Yeah. I do think that the emergence comes from mind ultimately.
Yeah. Yeah.
And my concern about all of that is that we are losing our sort of moral footing or foundations, and we'll be okay with a second best consciousness, you know? Because, I mean, just today, a friend of ours texted us an article about a fake, I don't even know how to describe it, like a robot that is an Instagram influencer and has 400,000 followers. It's not a real person. It's like a robot with a wig, and it's a Japanese like girl. And, you know, the whole thing is fake. And it's like, well, who cares what a fake person, but it's like, actually, we've been following fake people, so we might as well follow fake robots, you know, Kardashian. Anyway.
Oh, my gosh.
Oops, I probably shouldn't have said that. But anyway, no, I to get us off course. But yeah, that's my concern about, you know, if we're not morally grounded, then fake comes along, you know, and it's an acceptable substitute because we don't want the real thing. So I don't know.
Let me ask you one more question before we close out, although I have plenty more I could ask you, but yeah, we're right around an hour. You have used this word, and I've heard a lot of people use it, mind, the word mind, but you don't mean the human brain. So we've defined consciousness, we've defined personhood. Is mind the same as consciousness?
So I'm using the term mind broader so that it can include non-conscious conceptual things. So maybe you could have unconscious thoughts or beliefs that are buried in there, but they're part of your mind, or memories. So I'm thinking the mind is something broader that will include more elements.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I got it. So when we dream at night, I mean, some of the stuff that gets pulled up in dreams is not available to us in our conscious day-to-day lives. And some of it's memory, but would that be all subsumed under mind? That's the mind providing that little picture for us, or scary story.
Maybe God's mind, maybe God's spirit is speaking to you in dreams.
About that.
To fan into flames the mystics in the audience. You know, I mean, just like the biblical writers, they were mystics, right? They heard from God's spirit, maybe sometimes in dreams.
People in the Middle East right now are hearing from God in dreams left and right. Dreams and visions, pretty cool.
I was actually going to mention that earlier. That is a kind of category, you know, the category of like vision. Yeah. That's apart from quote unquote like material reality, I guess. But we, as Bible believers, we're like, yeah, no, that's right. You know, that's true. You know, the Stairway to Heaven or whatever, you know, not the Led Zeppelin song, but the Jacob's vision and all that. So we think that's real.
Yeah. When I was talking with my Bible study girls the other night about meditation, the difference between Eastern meditation and kind of the Christian discipline of meditating on God's word or whatever. And, you know, one of the big distinctions that people will make is that Eastern meditation is about emptying the mind, whereas typically Christian meditation is about focusing on God or scripture or an attribute of God or something like that. Right. And so all I could think is, when I try to fall asleep at night, I try my hardest to empty my mind, but the way that I try to empty my mind is always focusing on well, one, emptying my mind, or some little thing I've been taught about. Okay, it's an ocean and the thoughts are passing by like waves. Okay, well, that's a thought. Okay, so that's not empty. Okay,
you
I'll
can
just
focus
picture-
on your third eye.
Yeah, well, that's still a focal point, or like blackness, or there is no way to think nothing, right? Unless maybe you're in a coma. I wouldn't know because then I wasn't thinking. Oh, goodness. Well, I've confused myself and probably people in the audience, but any sort of final thoughts as we go out, or something you really hoped we would ask you about, or you wanted to say that you didn't get a chance to say?
Oh, no, your questions were really great. I think the final thought that I would have, it kind of goes along the lines of kind of what you were talking about, like what makes us special. And I don't know how I can like just say this, but like the more that I live, the more that I'm convinced that people are more special. I don't want this to sound cheesy, but maybe it has to. It's like people are so profoundly more special than they realize. When you see a baby, it's small. You don't know all of its capacities. You don't know that it's going to grow up and become a being that could create laws, that could create books. I mean, you kind of do know that from other experiences, but you don't know that just from looking at the size of its body. And I think in the same way, we don't know all the treasures that are in us. We know some of them, but there's more. And I think that we'll be spending all of eternity discovering more and more of the treasures that God has put deep into us. And that sense that you have when somebody insults you of feeling hurt, I think is the sense of your own worth. And I think that's why one of the greatest things that we can do for each other is to build each other up and be a mirror for their worth. And
I love that.
And to understand that the reason we feel injured is because we are so valuable.
Yeah. No, that's a really good word to end on. I didn't think it was cheesy at all. But then again, I was asking you from the beginning to tell me I was special, apparently. So, well, if listeners want to hear more from you, where is the best place for them to find you? Do you have like a YouTube channel or?
I do have Worldview Design YouTube. Also, probably the best thing is just go to my website, Joshua L. Rasmussen, or just type my name onto Google and you'll get all these free resources of things that I've published on these topics.
And it's actually a cool website. Like sometimes you go to a website and it's like, cool. Okay, they made
my wife designed it. Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Oh, cool. So she's beautiful and smart. That's awesome.
And yeah, creative, funny, and
okay,
artist.
We get every stop bragging.
You did well.
It's not about me. I'm not bragging about myself.
That's true. That's true. Yeah. Okay. Well, he kind of is.
He's
of course,
that
I did. I did
life.
Win her heart, you know, so I succeeded in that thing.
There we go. Well, we got a lot of single listeners out there that are like, oh, I don't have that. So anyway, maybe they're feeling jealous. Well, for us, again, just want to encourage people to check out the website, HoustonTOT.com. And on the podcast, whatever platform you use, rate us, review us, subscribe, do all the things you're supposed to do. On YouTube, they always say like, click this bell, click subscribe, just do all the things. Show us some love. Show us that you think we're special too. And until we see you again, we encourage you as always to question freely, think deeply, and disagree as needed.